history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some pretty incredible stories out there just waiting for you to ask a few of the right questions and take the time to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot, we're educated, entertained, and oftentimes inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I know that all of those are going to apply today to a conversation with Oscar Rice, 95 years old, of Denver, Colorado, but originally from the suburbs of Munich, Germany. And this is a story that's going to take us from the Holocaust to army decorations in World War II to the cutting edge of science. And if you're a male over 50, this man has probably impacted your life in a way that you would not even expect. But hopefully we'll have time to cover most of this. Let's start out early on, sir. You were born in Germany, one of three children in your family?
Yeah.
You had a brother and a sister?
Brother and sister.
Jewish family in the suburbs of Munich?
Well, actually, I was born in Bad Dürkheim, 20 miles from our Rammstein.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
But where'd you grow up?
In Munich. And then we moved to Munich in 1923 because the recession was so bad, there was no way to earn a living in the Rhineland.
What do you remember about your childhood? What kinds of things did you do?
Interestingly enough, I went, of course, to a Catholic grammar school run by the Benedictine sisters. But then Hitler, in 33 or 4, decreed that Jews could not go to ordinary, had to go to Jewish schools.
Uh-huh.
So then I went to an Orthodox Jewish school in Munich. And then after that, after I graduated, I went to Altes Real Gymnasium, which is the same thing as a high school, but much more advanced. By the way, I think Albert Einstein went to the same school.
Oh, really?
High school. So until Hitler gave in the full power, till 35, 36, there was no problem go to the school. But the Hitler Youth started to really harass me, us, the Jewish people, in wintertime, they throw snowballs at us that had an accident.
Mm.
And I went to school in a bicycle. They were in the air of the bicycle, ruining the bicycles too. And then one of the Hitler Youth that sat behind me was carrying a long knife, stick the knife in my back and said, when there were tests, especially math tests, where I was very good at, let's change tests.
Wow.
So my mother, father said, you got to get out of here. So I applied both for a visa to the United States and for a visa to go to Palestine.
Uh-huh.
And I had a very close friend, high school friend, which played chess. When I got the visa to come to the United States, I wanted to go with him, of course. But my mother says, you're going to the United States. So at 17, in those days, you don't disagree with your parents.
Well, yeah. But they're telling you it's not safe for you here. You have to go to America. You don't speak any English.
Yeah.
So you're sailing across the Atlantic Ocean.
But she knew where I was going because her aunt, who sponsored me, had connections with the ag school I went to.
An ag school that's now called Delaware Valley
University.
What you studied there was how to be a dairyman, right?
Well, that was my major. I also learned how to do other work, like to plow fields and spray orchard. They had five different departments.
Uh-huh.
What helped me with my English was the head of floriculture had got his degree from Heidelberg University and was fluent in German.
Uh-huh.
So as long as I was with him in the department, he helped me with my language.
So you picked up English pretty quick.
Yes. In 6 months, I was all right.
So you're over here. Your whole family is still in Germany. You're studying at this basically agricultural school, National Farm School it was called then. You end up getting out of there and running a dairy. But over this time period, how often did you hear from your family back home?
Very rarely, very rarely.
You had to be concerned about him, knowing what Hitler was about.
Of course. Then I asked my aunt to also give him visas, and she applied for it. But by the time the mail got to my parents, the American embassy in Stuttgart had closed because of the war, and there was nothing to be done anymore, that she couldn't do anything anymore.
And if your parents had waited a year, 2 years longer, you might not have made it to America.
Right.
But your little sister did.
Yeah. She went through southern France. But she was so traumatized, she didn't remember how the whole thing happened.
And we'll come back around to that. But I just want to establish that, that your parents had the foresight to help you and flee this situation, but they were stuck there.
And my sister, because we had relatives in Alsace-Lorraine, and they sent my sister, after the war has broken out, to Alsace-Lorraine. And then she went to southern France, around Marseille somewhere, and came to the United States.
Yeah, so here you've graduated from this university, and now you're running a dairy farm in Maryland, not far from Washington, D.C. In fact, you're delivering 250 gallons of milk into Washington, D.C., so I'm sure Congress loved you. And you did that for a couple years. They didn't need you for the war. They needed you in that job. And then when you decided that you might want to get in this war and go fight the man who's persecuting your family and so many others, they said, no, you can't. You're an enemy.
Yeah.
You have no idea what's happened to your family, right?
No, right. Absolutely no idea.
And you've got both your parents and your brother that are still back there.
And my grandparents.
And your grandparents.
All my grandparents.
And I can't imagine what that feels like, to be completely cut off and no idea and knowing that people are being persecuted and horrible things are happening. So then your sister comes, and that had to be pretty exciting.
Yeah, and she needed help. She arrived in Philadelphia. Our family just took care of her till I could get to Philadelphia.
And you quit your job to go there and help take care of her. And she ended up with a very successful career in the clothing business.
Women's clothing business, yeah.
But by 1943, they decide, oh, we changed our mind. We need some bodies now.
Well, the reason is that I worked in the creamery, so I wasn't essential anymore.
So since you stopped working at the creamery, you didn't have an exemption anymore?
Well, I don't know. I just got a letter from the draft board.
Uh-huh.
We report for induction.
But you're still not a U.S. citizen.
Nope.
You go into the Army. You're training.
Fort McCallum.
So you're out there shooting a machine gun?
Yeah.
And what did they do? They had you change targets real fast or something?
Yeah.
And they noticed how good you were at that?
Yeah.
Because you were real sharp in math. You could make the adjustments. Yeah. And so then they came to talk to you?
Yeah.
And they heard your accent?
Yeah.
What happened then?
Well, he said, we need you in Germany.
He realized you spoke German?
Yeah, fluent German. He says, we need you in Germany.
And he meant right then?
Right there. And he says, we can't send you because you're not a citizen. We got to make you a citizen.
So how'd they do that?
Well, they took me to the courthouse in Anniston, Alabama. The colonel went to see the judge and explained the situation to him. After I had filled out all the forms, I went into in the judge's chamber. And the judge looked at me and says, do you know anything about the Constitution? And I waved my pamphlet the Army had given me and says, yes, I've read it. And he said, you're a citizen.
Just like that.
And 3 weeks later, I was in Germany.
3 weeks later.
Yeah.
That's how badly they needed you. So they put you in the 79th Infantry Division.
Yeah.
You got there right as the Battle of the Bulge is going on,
right? Yeah, right. We were protecting the right flank of Patton's.
Uh-huh.
In the Battle of the Bulge.
Now, you had grown up in Germany. I know. I'm sure you'd had some rough winters.
Oh, yeah.
But what was that like, that winter of 44?
Digging a foxhole was terrible. It wasn't nice, let me put it this way. But I managed all right. As a matter of fact, interestingly enough, I told all my companions to not call me Oscar, my first name, because it's so Germanic. I used my middle name, Kully, K-U-L-L-Y.
Uh-huh.
That's my mother's maiden name was Kullmann. So that's why I'm Kully. Then I could overhear a lot of the German conversations, which helped us so strategically.
So if you had gone by Oscar, the enemy would have been tipped off and wouldn't have spoken German so freely.
Yeah.
But you're in a combat situation.
Oh, yeah.
You've got the enemy firing at you, and you're firing at them.
Oh, yeah. One night I went through a night patrol with an American Indian, a corporal. I learned how to behave in the woods at night. He knew his way around. He's the one that taught me how to stay alive under those conditions.
Did you think you were going to stay alive?
I had doubts because we were getting attacked by tanks and all this sort of thing.
And how often? I mean, here you are.
Yeah.
You're back in Europe. You're so close to your family, in theory. Well, you still don't know what's happened to him.
Right.
How often did you think about that?
Oh, constantly, of course.
And you're fighting this regime that is the reason you left Germany.
Well, yeah. That had something to do with my motivation. I rewarded a Silver Star.
You mentioned the Silver Star. So this takes place long after the Battle of the Bulge, after you guys, by hook or by crook, made it across the Rhine, which wasn't easy for you. And you're in a foxhole looking out, and what do you see?
I see movement, and I know what people. And in a foxhole, I know it was on the German side, so it must have been Germans.
And how far away were they?
About 100 yards.
And how many of them were there?
Well, actually, two. The army said three, but it was only two.
And what did you decide to do?
I decided to take my radio off and crawl in a ditch with my carbine. That took me within, maybe 5 feet of that foxhole. I got out, cocked my carbine first, of course, jumped out of the foxhole and told them the Germans to surrender.
And you said that in German?
In German, yeah.
Yeah.
And they immediately surrendered. Didn't have to do anything.
But that's a long way to crawl. And if you had alerted them somehow with some mistake before you got there, they would have shot you.
Yeah, of course.
So this, you were taking your life into your hands by doing this.
There's no question about that.
So you tell them to surrender. They do. And you say, now you have to follow me back over here.
Yeah, I follow you.
You force them to go. Yeah, exactly. And you notice something in their possession.
Yeah.
This is one of the reasons you got the Silver Star.
Yeah.
Tell me what you found.
I found a German map that had marked clearly the coordinates of the guns that they were using to destroy the pontoon bridge.
And this is why you had such a hard time getting across the Rhine.
Yeah.
They kept blowing up the pontoon bridge or the engineers' efforts to build one.
Yeah.
You discover this map that's got the gun positions.
We radioed back immediately the coordinates of the gun position.
And what happened next?
The guns started firing.
Not just any guns.
No, those were the kinds of size that the battleships had. They were sitting on the other side of the Rhine. They had to be taken apart. There were no type of guns that couldn't move. There was emplacements.
That's why I'm asking, because when people hear big guns, they think we're talking about maybe at most a 155.
Yeah.
This is a 250?
50 millimeter, yeah. At least that's what they told me. And they had to be taken apart into three pieces to be transported.
But they know exactly where to fire because of the map that you found.
Yeah.
So here you are back in your position, and you've got quite a show to behold.
Yeah.
Tell me what you saw and what you heard.
Well, they told us to get our heads down in the foxhole in case there was a short round. And they started firing for 15 minutes, TOT, time on target, and the shells going overhead sounded like a freight train going overhead. And I learned later, I didn't see the place, but the friends of mine that saw the place where the guns were said they were totally destroyed.
I would imagine so, with artillery of that caliber heading their way. And that's significant. I mean, the reason they're giving you the Silver Star is by capturing these guys, finding that map, they're able to destroy all these guns.
Yeah.
That allows them to get across the Rhine, and it probably saved a lot of American lives.
Sure.
Did you realize that at the time, how significant that was?
No, I didn't. That was a job. You know, when you're on the front line, see what a job that needs to be done. You don't worry about anything else. They say, how can I get it done and save my life?
Well, that was your number one job, survive.
Yeah.
How hard was that? Can you give us a sense of what that daily reality was for you?
Well, you know, I was scared crawling in the ditch. I was trying not to make any noise, and especially I tried to prevent any of the grass that showed from moving. I did everything I could think of to be safe.
Yeah.
But I couldn't control everything, obviously.
But
as a matter of fact, when I got close, I heard him talk in German. So I knew when I was close, I didn't have to look up.
Uh-huh. And that's just one day. You're over there for quite a while. But on any day, I mean, you can be hit by German artillery, by machine gun fire, bombers coming overhead.
More mortar fire.
Well, that's what got you.
Yeah.
And we're going to hear about that when we come back. The close call that left Oscar Rice with a Purple Heart. We'll learn what piece of equipment he was carrying that would end up saving his life. And also why we're all fortunate his life was spared, because his decades in science and medicine have been incredibly productive and innovative. Check out photos of Dr. Rice then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this.
If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country, and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with Dr. Oscar Cully Rice of Denver, Colorado. He'll be 96 in May, and he continues to occupy his magnificent mind with scientific breakthroughs he hasn't had time to complete yet. He came to America as a teenager, escaping the Holocaust, but not knowing what would become of his Jewish parents and other relatives in his native Germany. Before we left off, we heard about the courage he displayed while serving with the 79th Infantry Division and what he did to earn the Silver Star. But 3 days after that, he would be wounded in action and quite fortunate to survive. Dr. Rice, tell us what happened on March 27th, 1945.
The situation was as follows. There was a bridge across a fairly large river, not the size of the Rhine, but with binoculars you could see that there were bombs placed, explosives placed under the bridge. They were getting ready to blow the bridge up. And I went to the front line to observe what's going on. I did telephone the mayor of the city over on the other side, talked to him in German, but I didn't get any information that helped us really.
Did he know who you were?
No.
You basically prank called the mayor of the city to try to get intelligence?
Yeah.
How often did you do that?
That's the only time. The only other time I had contact with the mayor's office was in Alsace when we conquered the little town. Uh-huh. And I went in the mayor's office. The mayor was gone, of course. And I opened the drawer of his desk. On the right side, there was the armband of the Free French. On the other side was the armband of the swastika.
That kind of illustrates politicians for you, doesn't it?
Right.
So back to this. You call the mayor.
Yeah.
He doesn't give you anything.
No.
But so you're still there.
The only thing I learned is that there were only about one battalion of German soldiers stationed over there. But it did confirm that there were, in fact, German soldiers stationed on the other side of the bridge.
And what did you tell him to get him to tell you that?
Oh, I forgot. I pretending I was in German.
Just like a German civilian.
Yeah. I asked him, sind der Soldaten? Soldaten is the German name for soldiers. Soldaten. And he said, ja.
So at least you know there are some German soldiers there.
See, because if there wouldn't be any soldiers, our actions would be different. We would have waited. We wouldn't have to wait so long. We wouldn't have gone on the bridge because we wouldn't have to take the casualties if we had done that. But there were soldiers there. They were obviously on the other side watching and ready to blow the bridge if we'd gone across.
So you're saying because of that phone call, you guys didn't cross the bridge?
Yeah. I didn't give that order. I just explained to the captain, actually, what the guy had said, and he's the one that made the decision.
So, again, you may have saved a lot of lives.
Maybe. Who knows?
But very soon after that, your life was in danger.
Well, while I was in the front line with glasses watching what was going on, that's when, I suppose, it could have been a mortar shell from our side, but I don't think so. I think it was a mortar shell that the Germans.
And where did it hit?
Right behind me.
How close?
Oh, probably less than 10 feet.
Less than 10 feet. So you get shrapnel in your legs and in your rear end.
Yeah, but mostly in the radio.
Mostly in the radio.
Yeah.
So when you got the Silver Star, you'd left the radio behind in your foxhole.
Yeah.
Good thing you had it on your back this time.
Right. Absolutely right.
What do you think would have happened if you weren't wearing that radio?
I'd be dead.
Because that shrapnel would have gone right through your rib cage and into all your internal organs.
Right.
Well, that's a pretty close call, isn't it?
Right.
Did it take you a minute to figure that out? To figure out what kind of shape you were in?
Oh, yeah. And I called for the medic. The medic gave me some morphine and says, go back to the first aid station.
And how long did it take you to recover?
About 3 weeks.
You're out of commission for 3 weeks. What'd you think about during that time?
I don't know. I was dazed for...
When you're in that situation, does that thought enter your mind? Wow, that could have been me?
Oh, yeah, of course.
And I just think of everything that you've accomplished in your life since the war. None of these things would have ever happened.
Right.
And there's a lot of chemistry and medicine innovations that have occurred because you're still alive. So they let you out of the hospital.
Yeah, to replacement depot.
Which means you're probably going to join some other unit where you don't know anybody.
Right. And my job was at night to sit without weapon and make sure that none of the prisoners escape. Because they were afraid that we were going to shoot prisoners.
And these are German prisoners?
Yeah.
Did you talk to many of them?
No. I was in no condition.
But you recognized something?
Yeah, a truck from our battalion. The big trucks were marked B Battalion, 79th Infantry Division.
What'd you do?
Well, I talked to the driver, and he said, get in, I'll take you back to your battalion.
You didn't have orders for that, though?
No. I was AWL on paper, but the colonel took care of us.
And this is the colonel who you'd had a long-standing relationship with?
Yeah, yeah.
He's the one that wanted you over there because of your German skills. So what happened from there, the rest of your time over there in Europe before the surrender?
Okay.
What were some of the things you did and some of the things that stand out?
We went across Germany pretty easily. We didn't have to do much fighting and landed up in Czechoslovakia near the city of Marienbad, Marianska in Czech. After a week or two, the colonel got orders to join the 1st Division in Nuremberg, and Colonel called Ike and had me transferred with him, essentially. It was separate. He went first, but just a couple of days later.
And up until this point, have you gotten any clues to what happened to your family?
No, not until I went to Munich to the headquarters where all the records were kept and looked at the records. And I found out later the records were not accurate.
Well, I want to understand what this was like for you. And again, keeping in mind that you're still a very young man. So you're ordered to Nuremberg, and they're going to have you interrogate war criminals because you speak such great German.
Yeah.
Now, these are the war criminals that wanted to kill you and any other Jew they could find.
Yeah.
But to that point, you were okay with that idea.
I was hesitant even then.
Yeah.
You shouldn't say. I was not ready to tell my colonel no.
Sure.
But after seeing the records.
So tell me about this. So you go to Munich, and what's in Munich?
All the records are kept in Munich.
And you mean all the records from the entire Holocaust?
Yeah. They were later transferred to another place, and any correction were made. The Holocaust Museum in Washington put me up to that, to go to the records at the other place.
Uh-huh.
To make sure, like they had, my parents were loaded in a cattle train, and in Munich it said they were taken to Riga, Latvia, executed there, but the train never made it to Riga. It stopped.
What I want to understand is what knowledge you are receiving at the time, because you get to Munich, and here is this vast trove of records. Was it a needle in a haystack to find your family in there?
No, no. It was filed under my regular name, Rice.
So you look up Rice.
Yeah.
And as you get to that spot, is your heart pounding a little bit? Or did you think you already knew what you were going to find?
I think I knew what I was going to find. I had enough stories. When we went across from the Rhine to Czechoslovakia, we were very close to the Belsen concentration.
Bergen-Belsen,
Bergen-Belsen. And there, you know, in the army, rumors fly. We knew that it was very bad.
But now you're opening up a file.
Yeah.
And you see right there, and it has your parents' name.
Yeah, that's in here. The only thing that was wrong is that didn't go to Rieger, they went to Kaunas.
But you're looking at a paper that says your parents are dead.
Yeah, and my grandparents. My grandparents went to Theresienstadt.
And what about your brother?
Oh, he went with my parents.
What did that do to you, to see that in print?
Oh, it's hard to take, let's put it this way. If I would have had a German that was bothering me, I might have shot him, without question.
So you find out that your parents, your grandparents, your brother are all victims of the Holocaust.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you're also thinking at some point, that's what would have happened to me.
Sure.
Yet you go back to Nuremberg, and they still expect you to interrogate these guys.
Yeah.
So what'd you do?
I told the colonel I couldn't do it emotionally, and he understood.
So instead, they have you taking care of hotel rooms for the jurors who are coming in for the Nuremberg trials.
Yeah.
And then they give you a pretty interesting job, one that still is impacting what people in Germany read today, right?
Sure.
Tell me what you did.
Well, we started the first German newspaper, interrogated the personnel that did not have any Nazi affiliation, that they were clean. We started the first German newspaper, and it's still in the same paper, Süddeutsche Zeitung. It's still working.
And there's a funny story there about they got tired of seeing that same Gothic typeface that Hitler had used, right?
Yeah.
So we don't want this anymore.
No, it was the Americans that objected. The Germans didn't object.
But the Americans said, that's Hitler's type font.
That's right.
And we want you to find another printing press with Roman style.
Yeah.
And you couldn't do that.
There was no type available.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned something there. As you are vetting the people who are going to work for this newspaper, it's up to you to decide whether or not they were Nazi sympathizers?
There was a committee of 5 or 6 army people doing it.
How seriously did you take that job?
Very seriously.
Well, yeah, I would think so. And how could you, what was the determining factor for you?
How much were they actively involved in Nazi propaganda? That had to be that they were in the army, that was not a criterion because they were drafted. But how active were they actually in the Nazi party?
Mm-hmm. It's a lot of power.
Mm-hmm.
You're basically saying, good, bad, good, bad, good, bad.
Right. That's what they wanted us to do.
Yeah.
The Germans wanted to start the opera again. When we asked them, what opera are you going to use? Oh, they said, we're doing a Wagnerian opera. I said, you're not going to do a Wagnerian opera. Then they said, how about Fidelio? That's the only opera that Beethoven wrote.
Uh-huh.
And I said, sure, go ahead. But we did reserve the King's Loge for American personnel.
Uh-huh.
I saw Fidelio 3 times.
Some people may not understand why you were so opposed to Wagner or any of his music.
Well, Wagner was an anti-Semite of first degree, associated with the Nazi Party, and our maid in our house occasionally worked in Wagner's house, and she says he's the biggest woman hater she's seen.
So there was no way you were going to sign off on Wagnerian operas.
No.
So Beethoven it was. And eventually, and I know we can't possibly cover your whole career here, but here's a guy who has escaped Hitler's Third Reich as a Jew, makes it to America, doesn't speak any English, makes it through college, gets a degree in animal science, runs a dairy before he ends up in the army, gets a Silver Star, he's wounded in action, Purple Heart, this incredible turn of events at the end of the war where you get to see in your own hands what happened to your parents. You're working around the biggest names in the American government. You're around Eisenhower and all kinds of people. Then you come back to the States. You turn down a commission that they offered you in the Army. You come home and go back to college and end up in a long career in biochemistry. You got your PhD at the University of Chicago. And while you're there, here comes another famous name. You knew Enrico Fermi?
Yes. A very humble man.
Uh-huh.
Extremely humble.
How did you get to know him?
The first meeting of Enrico Fermi was very interesting from science point of view. I went to a seminar on physiology by a very famous physiologist called Shedlovsky.
Uh-huh.
And he had developed a formula for nerve conduction. And Fermi went there because he thought this formula was incorrect. So they argued about the electronics of nerve conduction.
You knew who he was and how significant he was.
Yeah, I talked to him. I met him many times in the chemistry department. He used to come over quite a bit.
And you use the word humble, and you have a funny story that illustrates that. When your brother-in-law came to visit?
Yeah, I showed him the west stands where the reactor was.
So this is where they'd carried out the Manhattan Project.
Yeah, yeah. The reason for it was that Fermi was originally in New York. But there was no way that they felt they could have anything as dangerous as the first nuclear reactor in New York City.
Yeah.
The west stands were not used at all. Since it was in the football field, they were thinking it was a little safer distance from everything else. It wasn't. If it would have gone bad, it would have been terrible.
It would have been disastrous. Yeah. So you're right there where all this has happened, and your brother-in-law is with you.
Yeah.
And what happened next?
A big Cadillac drove up. And my brother-in-law asked, is this Enrico Fermi? I said, no, that's the electrician. And then a very dilapidated one-speed bicycle drove up, and that was Fermi.
Did he believe you, your brother-in-law?
He believed anything I said.
Well, a lot of people wouldn't believe your life story. It's kind of hard to believe. It's pretty. Do you ever think about that, how improbable your story is?
Yeah.
And that's just at the University of Chicago, where you're getting your PhD. You work around a lot of Nobel Prize winners, and you end up with a long career lecturing at Johns Hopkins and then moving here to Colorado in 1959. But even while you're at Johns Hopkins, Salk and Sabin designed the polio vaccine, and you're there with Sabin and the monkeys he experimented on?
Oh, those monkeys were terrible. They had to wear gloves that had steel in them. The handlers, I used to watch them. They bit, they were really nasty. And those were the only strain of monkeys that could be used for that purpose.
So you rubbed shoulders with some of the people who changed science and medicine in the 20th century. Fermi and Sabin were just a couple, but you would leave your own impact, and I don't think we could even count the number of people listening right now who have probably taken a potentially life-saving test that you came up with. Oscar Rice will explain which test that is when we come back. Check out the photos at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll get the rest of this 95-year-old's incredible story right after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and the incredible journey of Dr. Oscar Rice. He fled Germany as a teenager, became a decorated infantryman for America in World War II, receiving the Silver Star and the Purple Heart, among others. He would learn that his brother, his parents, and his grandparents were among the more than 6 million Jews killed by the Nazi regime. And this young man who was spared that fate, a young man who came to America not speaking a word of English, who had been a dairyman before the war, he would take advantage of the GI Bill to go on and earn a PhD in biochemistry at the University of Chicago. And he has been producing scientific and medical breakthroughs ever since. In fact, I think when you hear about some of these, you're going to realize he's likely had an impact on your life. I know we don't have time to go through all of them, but Dr. Rice, what are some of the innovations or discoveries that you're most proud of?
It's got to be my publications in environmental medicine. But really, if you want to come down to facts, it's the development of the PSA.
All right, so let's touch on some of these. So first of all, In the 1960s, when radio ads and television ads and newspaper ads and every billboard still says smoke a Camel or a Marlboro Virginia Slims, you wrote the first paper?
We, with three people.
And what was the conclusion of that research project?
That in homozygous emphysema, you shorten your lifetime 50% if you smoke.
And that was the first scientific paper that suggested smoking reduces your lifespan.
Yeah.
And now that's a given. Kids today, they don't know that we ever didn't know that.
Yeah.
And maybe people didn't listen early enough. Was it hard for you to see that continue over time?
Oh, yeah, of course it's hard. I went to a conference at the University of Chicago on the future of democracy. One of the senators from Illinois. Now I won't talk about the gender because it would give it away. What took you 30-some years to pass a law against smoking? And the answer was, why do you think it took so long?
The industry.
Yeah.
So you were certainly ahead of the game there. You even helped solve a problem that NASA was having.
Yeah, by accident.
Well, don't the best things happen by accident?
Serendipity is called.
So you're here in Colorado, and there's a chemist who's working with you who's trying to figure out what's wrong with the hydraulic fluid they're using on NASA rockets.
Yeah.
So you put it in your centrifuge, and what do you discover?
That there was mercury in it.
Because he had noticed it's cloudy.
Yeah.
If he didn't notice that, you're not going to put it in there. So you notice there's mercury, and why was that a problem?
Because mercury amalgamates brass and doesn't permit the valves to open.
So the valves were not opening because there was mercury in the fluid.
Yeah.
So you get mercury out of the fluid, and now their rockets work fine. All right. So there's another one. You're still working in environmental medicine. You had some breakthroughs identifying the factors in infantile distress syndrome. And then in 1970, there's something that now everybody knows about that back then nobody knew about. The very first Earth Day address?
Yeah, at the New Jersey College of Medicine.
What'd you say?
I warned everybody about lead poisoning because in the ghettos there, the kids were, of course, starving. They were eating the paint that had lead in it. Of course, nowadays, all the paint companies use titanium for lead.
Yeah.
So already in 70, it was clear how dangerous lead was.
And you mentioned something when I asked you about your achievements in this field, the PSA test. Now, every man knows what a PSA test is, and anybody in the right age group has had one. And without it, they wouldn't know whether or not they have indicators of prostate cancer.
That's right. And this is a good indicator of prostate cancer.
How did you develop that?
A student of mine went out to California, and he got very interested in immunology. And he is now, by the way, with Eli Lilly as a co-director of one of their labs. We were kicking it around, so to speak. What if we could develop a blood test to detect prostate cancer? It was well known that prostate contains a lot of the enzyme called phosphatase. He did the early development on that. But then when it came to putting the final touches on, namely getting permission from the FDA to market it, I did all the work. Well, and Bell Bonfils helped me because I had to get 180 blood samples of people that weren't on aspirin because aspirin interferes with the process.
Uh-huh.
So we need to call it a joint project.
Sure. Most major achievements take a team of people, not just one. But without you, we might not have a PSA test.
Well, somebody else would have probably developed on that, but it took a lot of concentration to do it. I had the luck that one of the premier pathologists that was working with prostate was still alive at the University of Colorado Medical Center. Gary Miller was his name.
And I'm struck by this. I'm not trying to be melodramatic.
I know.
But you did some things in the Army in World War II that saved fellow soldiers' lives. The lives you most desperately wanted to save, your family, you couldn't. Because of Hitler. And now, all these years later, you develop a test that, I mean, I have to imagine, has helped save thousands of lives, if not millions.
Well, that's why I went to science, helped do some social work.
What was your motivation all this time?
Well, it developed, really. Chemistry professor at the Ag School, my experience with the cattle field at Ellicott City, and then, of course, with the chemistry department. There was a chemist, a very famous chemist, who was Ike's special scientific advisor, Westheimer. You make all these contacts of people that are scientists, so they stimulate you. to try to find out what's going on in your body and what we can do to improve diseases.
Have you ever thought about that? Have you ever tried to quantify how many people have survived or been able to treat prostate cancer because they got warning?
No, I don't know.
Do you think I'm off in my estimate?
I don't think so. It makes me feel proud that I was able to contribute something.
And ultimately, on that end, I guess we have your parents to thank for their foresight in sending you to this country.
Especially my mother, who constantly said to me, get educated. That's something they never can take away from you. That's who gets credit for it, who deserves the credit for it.
I guess I have to ask, in light of all these breakthroughs that you've been a part of, whether you set out to do that or not, is there a question, a dilemma, a puzzle, or enigma that faces humanity that you think about and you'd like to try to solve?
Yes, I have two ways to answer that. I have some evidence that pesticides are more toxic than we currently think from preliminary experiments with medical students in the 1970s, okay? I tried it 3 or 4 times. I tried to get money for it to follow up on it.
To really bear out that research.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And then it was turned down every time. And the reason it was turned down, and I'm fairly sure, I'm not 100% sure, is that the chairman of the committee that works on the grants, I was violating his dogma. He set the dogma for the levels of pesticides with basically poor experiments. I did it by inhalation, which is the way it has to be done, and he did it by just injecting the pesticides in the perineum of animals and seeing when he could find symptoms.
Were those specific pesticides? I mean, this isn't a blanket statement about all pesticides.
No. I can make the statement for this sulfur-containing pesticides, parathione, malathione. When a THI have in it, then the sulfur pesticides. The other one, I can't talk for the other ones.
So it's your conviction that if someone were to do a scientific study along your parameters that they would find that there's a greater toxicity than we currently understand.
And there are multiple possible implications. And I don't want to talk about the implications, but there are tremendous implications. And I'll give you one example. A bunch of women epidemiologists at Berkeley, Princeton, and I think it's Harvard or Yale, I don't know, published articles that pregnant mothers that are exposed to pesticides have a much higher incidence to give birth to ADH children. Hmm. And I think there's a chemical connection between the two, and that needs to be established to be sure that this is so.
Well, and if you never investigate, you never know.
Yeah.
And you said you had two answers. What was the other one?
It's very hard because I have to go into science to explain to you. And I don't know if you want to get involved in that. There is an enzyme that's only in the lung that is called an alkyl hydrolase, which, in my opinion, controls a substance in the blood which is present in very small quantities. And this enzyme hydrolyzes it and makes it inactive. And this substance acts on the cannabinoid receptors in the brain, which controls, and that has not been finite established, controls the calcium metabolism of the nervous system. And calcium is an essential component for nerve conduction. So
what you're saying is that this area of research would have a great impact on one of the things that's really happening right now, which is the greater use of marijuana and cannabis products.
I don't know if the cannabis, if they're involved. I'm very hesitant to say that. I'm only saying that it's the receptor in the brain, like the morphine receptors, there is a cannabinoid receptor. If it's disturbed, causes trouble in the nervous system.
So the implication is, if you fully understood this, you would greater understand the effects of marijuana on the nervous system.
Right.
Which would be a good thing to know when states are legalizing it, including yours.
Yeah. But this is a long projection. It would take at least 3 to 4 years to definitely establish. And the collaboration, I'd need the radiologists to locate the cannabinoid receptors, which has not been done to my knowledge.
It would be an important thing to do.
Yeah.
Well, Well, you said it'll take 3 or 4 years. You're only 95. What are you waiting for?
Money to do it.
And serious question. I mean, everybody hears how sharp you are, how vibrant you are. If somebody said, we're giving you a grant right now, put together your team to study this, would you do it?
Sure.
I believe you.
Yeah, but I must tell you that a student of mine that I'm very close to, because he became the chief pulmonary pathologist at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. And he understood all the I could explain to him all the chemistry behind it.
Yeah.
And he says, forget about doing experiments. Just write it up as a hypothesis and let other people do the experiments. And I'm maybe tempted to do it.
I think you should. I think future generations might appreciate that. I know there's plenty that they already appreciate that you've done in your career. And I'm sure we could sit here for hours and hours talking about it, but I don't want to forget to say thank you.
Oh, yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for coming up with a test I'm going to have to take someday to make sure I don't have prostate cancer. I do want to ask you, what would you say you're most thankful for?
That I made it through World War II.
Yeah, the story ends there if you don't.
Yeah.
There's three daughters that never would have been born.
Yeah, right.
And what are you most proud of?
What my daughters are doing, molecular genetics. She's working hard on that, and she's consulting to Los Alamos, some of the work they do and genetics they're doing, and she's also volunteered to teach young Latino students about science.
Very cool.
The other daughter, which is now doing some real good dietitian work in Houston.
I do want to ask you, because you have probably as powerful a perspective as anyone could on the Holocaust. People today, most of us, didn't live through it. What do people today need to understand, need to remember, and need to watch out for?
What I worry about is still the amount of anti-Semitism that is present. This is undeniable.
What's the answer? What's the remedy?
Keeping an eye on it and publishing it and publishing it and make people feel bad about it. And that the Jewish race has committed it not only to certain sins, but they have also had a lot to do with social advances.
Well, and if you don't like this question, you don't have to answer it. But the one question I didn't ask you, if I think about the history of the Jewish people, I mean, it all comes back to a relationship with the Almighty,
right,
and a plan that he had for you. When you look at your story and where you were and what you went through and what you've been able to do in your life, do you feel like he had a plan for your life? Do you see divine intervention in your story?
To a certain extent, yes. I wouldn't say total extent, but to a certain extent, yes. I still go to Jewish services at the high holidays and things like this.
Well, here's hoping there are many more holidays and, who knows, more scientific breakthroughs for Oscar Rice, 95 years old, soon to be 96, of Denver, Colorado. There's so much we didn't have time to touch on, like the trees he had planted in the Martyrs Forest outside Jerusalem, a memorial to the family members he lost in the Holocaust. If you visit Jerusalem and you go to Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Museum there, you'll even find items donated by Dr. Rice on display. I can't send you to Jerusalem, but I can point you toward the Hometown Heroes Facebook page or to hometownheroesradio.com for photos connected to this really remarkable story that I trust has amazed you the way it has me. We're out of time today, but thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.